Hello, Sangha. How's it going out there? Ah, thumbs up. It's good. How's it going in there? So I want to give great gratitude to Bhante Gunaratna for this quote I'm about to read that my teacher Howie Cohn shared a portion of it on a frequent basis. He's talking about mindfulness of breathing. And he said, when you first begin this procedure, expect to face some difficulties. Your mind will wander off constantly, darting around like a drunken bumblebee and zooming off on wild tangents. Somewhere in this process, you will come face to face with the sudden and shocking realization that you are completely crazy. Your mind is a shrieking, gibbering madhouse on wheels, barreling pell-mell down the hill, utterly out of control and hopeless. No problem, you are not crazier than you were yesterday. It has always been this way. You just never noticed. You are also no crazier than everybody else around you. The only real difference is that you have confronted this situation. They have not. So they still feel relatively comfortable. That does not mean they are better off. Ignorance may be bliss, but it does not lead to liberation. So don't let this realization unsettle you. It is a milestone, actually, a sign of real progress. The very fact that you have looked at the problem straight in the eye means that you are on your way up and out of it. So, yeah, I feel like we have to see this numerous times. The craziness of the mind. And something really strongly, really strongly there's some strong forces in the mind not wanting us to be right here, right now, present, aware of what's happening right now, right? Something, you know, some forces in the mind kind of really wanting to keep us from the truth. And we have a sense of that somewhere in us. We have a sense that there is a truth, there are truths that we could access if we could actually work with this mind and be more and more present and aware moment to moment. And I'm going to talk about what this training of the mind to actually do that, the truths that it can illuminate for us, that this insight practice can illuminate for us. So basically kind of what is insight? So insight is just in a super nutshell, it's kind of small and large seeings, meaning seeings that are deep and intuitive understandings, knowings, into the three characteristics. And technically they're called often the three universal characteristics of conditioned phenomena. And there's been, you know, references to them in some of the talks and instructions, but I'm going to dive into exploring these in a little bit more detail. So that's a mouthful, the three universal characteristics of conditioned phenomena. We just call them the three characteristics. What are conditioned phenomena? It is all of our experiences of body and mind, all of them. Except for Nibbana. Unconditioned. So I'm going to talk about these three characteristics, and you know, I'm just going to be able to kind of give you all a little taste, but hopefully it will just kind of spark a seed or be helpful to you, because each of these characteristics could be, you know, easily the topic of a single talk. I'm going to touch on all three of them. And I'm also going to kind of relate how our deeper understandings of these through practice can support us in the ways we want to show up in the world, because we're social relational beings, right? And many of us want, part of our aim, our noble, wholesome aims, are to bring greater wisdom and compassion to the world and be effective in advocating for things that are important to us. And so I'm going to point to just some of the ways that our insight can serve us in those noble aims that we have to help others, to contribute. And also tie in some of the reasons that, in particular, the noting practice supports the development of this insight into the three characteristics. So as I talk about the three characteristics, I'm going to use as a guide actually my favorite Dharma poem. And it is a poem that is said to be a poem about Taijitsu, who was an 18th century abbess of a Zen Buddhist monastery. So a nun many, many, many years ago. And it is essentially a poem about her awakening. So here is the poem. She saw that arising phenomena arose, abided, and passed away. She saw that the knowing of this arose, abided, and passed away. Then she knew that there was nothing more than this, no ground, nothing to lean on stronger than the cane she held, nothing to lean upon at all, and no one leaning. And she opened the clenched fist in her mind and let go and fell into the midst of everything. So, as you may see from even just from this poem, the what are called the three characteristics are not really separate things, but more different ways of looking at a single truth of the way things are. So sometimes it seems like we're looking through a different frame, but at the same thing with each of these phenomena. And the first is anicca, impermanence. And the second is dukkha, which is really kind of untranslatable. And I'll get into that more frequently. It's often translated as suffering. But it is perhaps more accurately described as unreliability or dissatisfactoriness. Those are at least aspects of it, and I'll get into that more. And the final third characteristic is anatta, or not self. So each of these sentences or parts of the phrases of the poem correspond kind of a little bit more closely, in my view, to one or other of the characteristics. So starting with anicca, the first couple of sentences, she saw that arising phenomena arose, abided, and passed away. She saw that the knowing of this arose, abided, and passed away. So this is pointing most to the anicca impermanence characteristic of the truth of the way things are. And this is referring not just to a gross impermanence that we all are, you know, or many of us are intimately familiar with, the fact that we will pass away, mortality, the fact that there was a last year, there was a 2021, and now we're in 2022, the passage of time. This is really pointing to the fact that all of these, the experiences we have of body and mind are really ephemeral, slipping away in any moment. They're ephemeral, they're transient. So other translations for anicca are inconstancy or just change and the constant change of our experience. So this is happening at every sense door all the time. And so I think it might have been Deb who went through and talked about the six sense doors that make up our experience. The Buddha saw that, you know, all of our experiences are sense experiences arising at any of these six sense doors. The five that we're familiar with, you know, the smell, sight, sound, taste, physical sensations, and thought and emotion. The sense, there are the sense objects that are arising at the sense door of the mind, moods, images. The mind is just considered to be another sense door, and the objects arising in it, the thoughts and the emotions, just like sounds arising at the ear door, coming and going. So this is happening, this ephemerality of these experiences is happening all the time. We're actually really just completely living in anicca. We're living in in impermanence all the time, kind of waiting in it. We begin to see this in practice, and some of you have reflected seeing this in moments. Start to see closer the beginning, the middle, the end of an in-breath or an out-breath. Or see just noting a thought and seeing a thought just disappear, right, in a moment. And we need to see that as we notice that, it's the accumulation of that kind of those kinds of seeings that can lead to the wisdom we're seeking in terms of the closer understanding, deeper intuitive understanding of anicca, of impermanence. And now maybe you're getting a little bit of a sense of why we're instructing, why this noting instruction could be helpful. Because it's drawing our attention to closer and closer into the detail of experience. So if we're noting rising, we're knowing what's actually happening in that experience. We're knowing what's actually happening, the physical sensations in a few of those moments. We're starting to come closer and closer to seeing more of those moments. And so to see the moments slipping away, arising and passing. And as we do that more and more, the moments, Joseph Goldstein talks about it as we can, over time, have more notings per minute. I think he talks about how many notings per minute can we get to. Now, we don't want to stress and strain ourselves, and we've been really clear about that and trying to do that. But it's just the actual, karmic law, that the more we incline our minds in this direction of mindfulness moment to moment, of what's happening at our sense doors, the more that mindfulness that and the precision of that mindfulness will increase in the future. And I referenced that kind of karmic law in the metta instructions, that the Buddha said, whatever we think or ponder upon will be the inclination of our mind in the future, which to me really means whatever we incline our minds towards, whatever we cultivate in our minds will develop more in the future. This includes mindfulness. So we'll come closer and closer to seeing more and more of the detail of our experience. So this anicca impermanence is happening at every sense door, including seeing, hearing, right? And it's our concepts, to a large degree, that keep us in a mistaken, continue to have the mistaken perception of permanence or solidity in things. So when we're noticing something, we're drawing you to notice the elemental nature of what's arising in a moment, such as the physical sensations of the rising and falling, or in the body, noticing softness or coolness or vibration, because sort of above that experience are even higher concepts of, say, like a hand is a concept, pain is a higher concept, the rising, what's actually happening? We're pointing towards that, what's actually happening? And so when we get to the knowing part, which Deb referred to, the note just kind of puts a sticker on what's actually the mind can know beneath the concept. And when we begin to see the moments in each sense door, then below the concepts, that's when we can start to, this insight can start to unfold even more strongly. So we can see this even in, concepts in seeing. So I said hand is a concept. Well, impermanence, we're swimming in it, right? So, is this the same hand as this hand? It's this hand. Is it? Our mind says this is a hand. Is it the same hand as this hand? So that's kind of what we're pointing to in our practice over and over. Yeah, actually, in a way, with that question. So in Taijutsu's poem, it's not just about, she goes on, there's two sentences here that are kind of focused on Anicca, right? First she says, she saw that arising phenomena arose, abided, and passed away. She saw that the knowing of this arose, abided, and passed away. So even the knowing, even with every, you know, with every sense experience that we're having, there's a knowing of it. And we can even begin to see that this consciousness that we take to be solid and permanent is a knowing of a moment of experience that's arising and passing. So having these insights into Anicca support us in any of the aims that we have to show up in the world in a particular way, aligned with our values? Just a couple of pointers here to how it supports the development of our mind in a way that can impact the world. When we see Anicca more deeply, when we understand it more deeply, what that can give rise to is the development of what we call more equanimity, more non-reactivity. When we know that pleasant, unpleasant, or neither experience is just arising and passing, what we also see is the harming that happens internally when we push away at that experience, when we push away at unpleasant experience or try to hold on to what's pleasant or just space out in unawareness, which is the habit we have with experience that's neither pleasant nor unpleasant. So the mind starts to actually go towards ease and the ease and greater peace of equanimity, which is this non-reactivity. And that can empower us to be able to not get so snowed under by the reactivity. Like if we have things we're frustrated about that are happening in our local community or in the world, it can help support us to not be so burnt out or frustrated in working towards making those kinds of changes that we want to make. So I'd like to share this particular quote from the Reverend Howard Thurman, who was a great civil rights leader. And he uses kind of arcane language. He uses the, he pronoun. I'll just share as he did, because he was writing, in the civil rights era. And another word for this equanimity that we can develop is equilibrium. It's this balance. It's the ability to stay steady in the midst of all of these changing circumstances that we're not in control of. And he said, if a man knows precisely what he can do to you or what epithet he can hurl against you in order to make you lose your temper, your equilibrium, then he can always keep you under subjection. So this ability to have equilibrium can support us in not being so under subjection in our life. It can empower us. And also, Anicca, Kamala pointed to this, if we see it more clearly, understand it more deeply, it really, one of the things that it deeply can inculcate in our minds and our hearts is that there's nothing we can hold on to. There's nothing we own, actually, nothing of importance other than our non-harming intention in any given moment. Because we see it's all slipping away, and so we become very, very attuned to the importance of having our hearts be free of harming, having our hearts be in a mode of caring, because this moment is all that's there to be owned. It's all slipping away. So we become very attuned to when our hearts and minds are in a state that's actually something that would cause harm internally or externally, and we go towards the non-harming. So we become very attuned, and we can bring that into our lives in a way that impacts both ourselves and others. So, moving on to the second universal characteristic of conditioned phenomena, we start to see how these are really quite related and not actually separate. The second characteristic is dukkha. Dukkha. This corresponds, in my view, to the third sentence of Taijutsu's poem. So I'm going to read from the beginning and then just highlight the third sentence. She saw that arising phenomena arose, abided, and passed away. She saw that the knowing of this arose, abided, and passed away. Then she knew that there was nothing more than this, no ground, nothing to lean on stronger than the cane she held, nothing to lean upon at all. So no ground to hold on to. So pointing to the unreliability of this impermanent experience to bring us true happiness, the unreliability of that experience, we may try to hold on, right? And I'll point to this a little bit more, to pleasant experience as our strategy in the midst of all of this. That's our mistake. And so dukkha, often translated as suffering, also sometimes translated as unreliability, unsatisfactoriness, could be fragility. It really helps me in understanding dukkha to think about the etymological root of the word, right? This is a Pali word. The word in the language of that the Buddhist teachings were written down in that really just does not have an English translation. So I try to just say dukkha, but it helps me to think about the root of the word, which is it is rooted in the word for a wheel out of true on a cart. So think, you know, my father's from India. Think of if anyone has been anywhere close to a bullock cart or any kind of cart back 2600, that you can imagine in existence 2600 years ago that you would have to ride in with the wheel out of true. And that is how we're living life. We're riding along in a wheel out of true, you know, on a cart with a wheel out of true. So all of our conditioned experience is marked by this unsatisfactoriness. So there are three kinds of dukkha that we can see in our practice and that we come to see more closely over time. And the first is dukkha-dukkha, which is the physical and emotional mental suffering that we're all really familiar with, or we think we're really familiar with. And then we come to a retreat like this, and we get intimately familiar with the physical and mental suffering and how it shows up more closely, moment to moment. So we come to see, as we practice insight practice, that actually, we, in our unawareness, in our rushing through lives, in our habitual unawareness, we're not necessarily seeing the full spectrum of what's going on in terms of the afflictive emotions that might be there and the way in which physical suffering might be showing up for us. This is why there are actually kind of 10 characteristics, 10 qualities that we refer to that are called the paramis. I can't go into them, but there are qualities that support us in practice and that we develop over time. And it's kind of in the Buddha Dharma, aim of, you know, the idea is that actually we're cultivating these over lifetimes to support our awakening. And someone who is awakened is kind of perfected in them. One of them is honesty, truthfulness. So we need to, and we are becoming more kind of open and truthful about what's going on in here internally, what's going on in terms of our physical experience as human beings, what's going on emotionally, what our thoughts are, and about how we experience distress and this kind of dukkha because of that. So we see more like what is actually some of the afflictive emotions we have. What are they actually? Right? And many of you have talked about this, but we may know that in our lives we experience anxiety, but if we haven't turned towards that, and with mindfulness, accepting it just as it is, noticing what it feels like, are we really going to be able to understand what that is? So this is becoming more, this is how in our insight practice we start to see more of the truth of dukkha. And it includes the physical suffering we have, and many of you have talked about that. I remember I think I mentioned that I had the opportunity to practice with Sayadaw Upandita, one of Mahasi Sayadaw's really main students in Myanmar. And at the time, he was in his 90s. He was really actually, it turned out, in the last 4 months of his life. And so he's really elderly. So all I, at the time, he was just giving Dharma talks, not teaching anyone individually at all. And so essentially, I got to hear his Dharma talks. Some of the things that were shared in the Dharma talks were just really struck me. And one of the things, we're constantly, even as we're practicing this, learning about this dukkha, even. Like, what actually is anger? For example, the mental suffering that we often think we have and we think we know about. And one of the things he said about this in one of his Dharma talks was, when you're angry, when you have some form of anger, you really want to get that person. If you don't think that's true, check it. You need to look closer. You need to look closer. So what he was saying was, he was pointing to the way in which we can see in even these things that we think we're really familiar with, how does anger operate in the mind? In actuality, over the course of our practice, we come closer and closer to seeing how those afflictive emotions function and what is the mechanism of suffering there. So one time I was practicing with anger, and I just happened to be one of those moments where the conditions came together. I was practicing in daily life and noticing this really, I was really angry at that moment. And it was in a breakup situation, right? You can get really, it was a very unusual situation for me. So it was like the anger went really high up. And I just noticed in that moment, because for whatever reason, I was mindful, I was sitting in a restaurant, and the accumulation of mindful moments happened to come to fruition then, as I've said, happens. And then I noticed in this moment of rage, this entitlement that I felt that this, that my former partner should do what I want. Like, there was this entitlement there, and that it was completely without any justification. But I noticed that aspect of that suffering. So this is part of what we're doing. I hate to tell you. Noticing more of dukkha. So, and the second kind of dukkha is the dukkha of impermanence. The Pali word for this is viparinama dukkha. This refers to the fact that even our pleasant experience is marked by unsatisfactoriness because it's changing always. So, I'm going to refer to Sayadawji Steve Armstrong in a Dharma sharing that we had just this week up in room 203 when the teachers were talking. And one of the things he shared is his Dharma offering. something he has shared, I guess, over the years, this: comfort is not a goal worthy of the effort. Comfort is not a goal worthy of the effort. Now, that's deep, right? Part of it is the reason for that is because comfort is going to be slipping away. We're just pointing to some pleasant experience that is not reliable. And so our practice is actually to come to see that pleasant experience is unreliable, and also to come to see through our practice that it's not pleasantness which is the marker of quote-unquote good practice. And we start to see this over, it's part of the insight that we develop over time, that this practice is not about pleasant experience, but about something much, much deeper and much, much more profound, which is the purification of our hearts and minds from just seeking after pleasant experience and the actual inner turmoil that comes from that. So the third kind of dukkha actually kind of encompasses it all. And it's pretty existential. So it can be kind of the hardest to describe. But I'm going to, give some pointers here to it. It's called, in English, it's translated as the dukkha of conditionality. It's sankhara dukkha. And it's the dukkha of our experience because our experience is conditioned, because as beings we're experiencing these conditions and these impingement at all of our sense doors, which we can't control and we can't wall ourselves off from. And as a consequence of that, well, actually these conditions never quite come together. And that is a cause of our lack of ease. But in addition, all of these conditions require us to constantly have to take care of these bodies and these minds. And it's a never-ending and dukkha-filled experience. So people have been reporting in in at least one of the groups I was in, just this actually practicing a lot with being able to actually sit through uncomfortable experience of the body, and for the first time actually be able to be there, hold it, and actually not react in the way that they're used to doing, and seeing and just sitting with that wave of discomfort and then watching it kind of pass away. So it's said, Joseph Goldstein shares this quote, that movement masks dukkha. So we're constantly moving and shifting and changing to take care of these bodies. We have that. This is the pointer to the constant impingement that we're experiencing as human beings with these sensations in the body, coming and going. We have to do this constant upkeep of the body in these moment-to-moment movements, but also over in our lives. We have constantly doing that, and in our minds. Now, our minds, they're seriously seeking after some entertainment. that we're trying to take care of our minds. That's, what is this? Right? What is this that we're constantly reaching out for? It's the mind wants something, right? Constantly. So we're in that state of impingement, and that's what the dukkha of conditionality refers to. So now this is kind of my ode to my teacher's talk, I feel like, including the ones here. So just as an example of a kind of a what felt to me like a stark experience of the dukkha of conditionality, in the sense of just feeling that deep impingement, that inability to wall oneself off. I'll share this experience I had on retreat, in which in Kamala was one of my practice discussion teachers, and I was actually at Steve and Kamala's sanctuary in on Maui, and so I was in this beautiful environment, gorgeous, and but there's the mind, right? The shrieking madhouse. For a while, it was not a shrieking madhouse at all. I really got into the practice, and I was right there with the breath, and right there, oh, so much tranquility. You know, sitting peacefully on Maui. Pleasant feelings of the body. This is going on for sit after sit. Quiet, peaceful, tranquil, concentration. Hawaiian birds. And then this anger story came in, like it came in like a train. Was just like, oh, why did he say that? Why did he do that? I can't believe he did that. It was, and then I got up in the walking. It was still there. In the next sitting, it came back in waves. You know, and the tranquility, the peace, the concentration was just not there. And the anger stories were like, this is the thing, right? We notice the intensity. When the mindfulness is strong and the experience is difficult, we can actually see that so much more clearly. So the contractions of the anger were there. So, I had practiced enough that I knew also that these stories were like completely, there was just, they weren't worthy paying attention to. It didn't mind. I couldn't convince my mind to pay attention to them. They were just going to be happening. And so anyway, you know, I mentioned it to Kamala in the next time we talked, and I was like, and her response referred to this being in the suttas who embodies the defilements, the hindrances. Mara is this being who comes and visits practitioners and messes with their practice. And she said, Tara, that's Mara trying to solidify. So there's all these anger stories. And she said, Tara, that's Mara trying to solidify my experience, right? So I reached this point in time in which the conditioning of the mind was to go back into solidification, go back into, instead of seeing the impermanence, instead of seeing the not-self, instead of seeing the three characteristics, was to really just contract around experience and bring the mind into a place of seeing solidity where there was none. And it was really helpful, because we need to be reminded, when Kamala said that, it helps to have someone remind you of, even if you have some modicum of wisdom, we need it. We need those pointers. So with dukkha, as we see it more and more, another little poem that I feel like really kind of embodies our experience with dukkha, at least when we're not being able to meet our experience with mindfulness. This poem is just a haiku, short poem by Isa, Japanese poet. And he wrote, "A world of dew, and within every dewdrop, a world of struggle." So there's this dewiness of our experience. It's like the anicca. That's actually the nature of our experience. It's very tremulous. And we're struggling constantly against it, against that. And when we can let go of the struggle, that's when we can start to experience peace and ease. So there's hope in this practice, in part because we know that we want to see the truth more clearly, and becomes very can become quite compelling the kind of thing that would make someone come to a 9-day retreat at Insight Meditation Center in the Mahasi tradition. It can be quite compelling to begin to really see these truths more clearly. But along the way, we have to we see the suffering more so that we can see the mechanism of the cessation, right? We can't see that the mechanism of how the mind can feel peace if we don't see how we're making the mistake of going into this dukkha, the suffering more and more. So one time, another of my teachers, I went to him, Howard Cohn, and he shared with me, I was having another experience that was difficult in practice, and he shared with me a teaching of Sayadaw Upandita, who he said, my teacher said, he went to Sayadaw Upandita, and he was in distress and crying, and Sayadaw Upandita actually said, cry your eyes out. Cry your eyes out. In seeing, sometimes we need to do that, in seeing the difficulty of experience and seeing the dukkha. And, you know, I think, or at least this is what my teacher, Howard Cohn, said to me, his interpretation of it is, well, if you're in resistance, then you shouldn't be in resistance to the experience. To be in resistance is to have aversion. So to just let the sadness, when we see suffering more clearly, to let it be and to experience that as part of our practice. Sadness feels like this right now. Have that be there. So it's okay to cry in the hall, as it's okay to laugh, as I hope we've conveyed. And it's definitely part of what comes up in the practice. So seeing dukkha more clearly, having greater insight into dukkha helps us in our aims in life, in our social and relational lives, at least in this way, in that it tenderizes our hearts. We can't fail to see this dukkha is not about us, that it's not just us experiencing it. It's that the predicament that we're in. And as sentient beings. And so it can really crack our hearts wide open in a good way. And that can cause us to realign our priorities and really relate more through compassion and wisdom. So the final, the third characteristic is anatta. Not self. And this one, so that the conditioned phenomena that we experience we keep mistakenly taking them to be self, and they're not self. So this corresponds to one of the final phrases in Taijutsu's poem, which I'll read again from the beginning and highlight the part about anatta. She saw that arising phenomena arose, abided, and passed away. She saw that the knowing of this arose, abided, and passed away. Then she saw that there was nothing more than this, no ground, nothing to lean on stronger than the cane she held, nothing to lean upon at all, and no one leaning. And she opened the clenched fist in her mind and let go and fell into the midst of everything. So, and no one leaning. So people say this, you know, this is the hardest to grasp of the three characteristics. It's really cannot be intellectualized. Don't think about it. Don't intellectualize it. Just sit back and maybe, you know, just let the words wash over you. Maybe they don't make any sense. That's totally fine. I've sat through many Dharma talks where I'm not getting it, but it's touching on something, and maybe in the future it might come back to me, and sometimes the messages in Dharma talks, and I'm like, oh yeah, that's it, or I see that in my experience. So we can't, we shouldn't intellectualize not self, and also be really clear that it's not that there we let go of the self in practice. It's that actually the self is not there in our conditioned experience as we've mistaken it to be. A self. There's no, the actual teaching is that the conditioned phenomena that we experience, the experiences of body and mind, are not fit to be regarded as self. And why is that? In part because they're impermanent, which we've talked about. So we're constantly mistaking ephemeral experience to be something that could be grasped onto as a solid self because they're impermanent and because there are other aspects of them that we begin to see through practice. So beginning with sort of the way in which we can see not self through anicca, through impermanence, maybe not knowing it, you might have been seeing a little bit of this as you might have saw yourself, you know, having trains of thought where there was a really solid sense of self, like sitting there really wanting the bell to ring, being really caught up in being the person who wanted the bell to ring. That, you know, maybe it was triggered by some discomfort, and then suddenly you notice that that had slipped away, and instead you are, you know, the person who, you became the person who really, really is thinking about the mac and cheese that was for lunch, and kind of, and just enjoying the physical pleasure, you know, the pleasure of that memory, and then that slipped away. And then it's like, oh, supposed to be with the breath. And then maybe for a little while you were the person who was like the bad meditator who should have been with the breath. And then that slipped away. And so we see how we can begin to see how there are this way in which the mind creates a sense, a strong sense of self around experience. And then we start to see that that strong sense of self passes away at some point in time. And that can begin to, we can begin to start to see how actually at some point it starts to be, we start to realize that it's kind of like, well, maybe we have to accept that the gig is up. And and believing in, you know, taking these ideas about ourselves to be seriously is not in line with the truth of the way things are, that our thoughts about ourselves are not actually, we think that they're pointing towards a solid idea of us, and they're not. So we can really see this with the good meditator and the bad meditator. It's a good thing to practice with. I know it's never happened to any, you know, that none of you have been thinking at any point in time that you were either a good meditator or a bad meditator. But in my personal experience, it happened a lot for me when I was in that area, walking this way onto this cushion or walking out of the hall, that, you know, there was some thought of, I'm a good meditator or a bad meditator. And it would just flip-flop. You know, okay, you know, sometimes it was really like a lot of strings of bad meditator. But, you know, at some point, this is a really great thing to practice with, because we can begin to see that we get caught up in a very strong sense of self, and it's based on, a rising and passing experience. That's not fit to be regarded as self. So one of the other ways that we see anatta, not self, and that we start to see it through insight, and the Buddha pointed to, is that Our conditioned experience of body and mind is also not fit to be regarded as self because we're not in control of it. It's what's happening in any given moment. It just causes and conditions arising, coming together. And we're not in control of how those causes and conditions are coming together in any given moment. So this can be, hard to grasp. And again, not inviting you not to intellectualize it, but just to share a bit about it. Actually, from Mahasi Sayadaw, points out how the noting practice helps us to see this over time. So, for example, in noting, as we've been inviting you to do, things like the rising and falling or the changing of postures, the larger movements of the body, so like standing, sitting, bending, stretching, and so on, this is what Mahasi Sayadaw says in terms of how we start to see that what's actually happening are causes and conditions coming together rather than an entity that's self that's governing the situation. These things are actually not governable. So he says, when one clearly experiences the conditioned phenomena involved in rising, falling, sitting, bending, stretching, moving, and so on, one understands that even if one doesn't want these physical phenomena to arise, one cannot prevent them from doing so. They will arise when all the necessary causes and conditions come together. Even if one doesn't want these physical phenomena to disappear, one cannot prevent them from doing so. They will disappear when it is their time. There is no entity that possesses any control over these appearing and disappearing physical phenomena. There is no entity that is permanent and everlasting. There is no entity that carries out one's desires. So this takes precision and some continuity of mindfulness, concentration, which is really just a continuity of mindfulness, moments of mindfulness strung together to begin to see. And that's how the noting practice kind of draws our attention to that and supports that cultivation of the continuity of mindfulness. So just to illustrate how it can do that, there was actually one of the reasons that this particular practice has been so supportive for me, and I'm so grateful for it, is the way I've seen that noting practice supported me in seeing these more and more, this kind of a truth. So there was one time that I was on retreat at Spirit Rock Meditation Center in California, and I was doing walking meditation. And at one point, I just noticed, I think the mindfulness is going okay in the walking meditation, but I was really spacing out on the turning. I was like really spacing out on the turning, so I decided I was really going to note the turning. So I was doing my walking, and then I got to the turning, and I was like, okay, turning, noted the turning. And just in that turning around, I landed on, the next thing I saw was this woman walking out of the hall. And just from that little bit more close, precise awareness of being aware in the turning, what I realized, and it shook me, because some of these insights really kind of shake you to see something more deeply, was there was no control over what was going to come into my view in that moment. There was no control. Was causes and conditions coming together, the door opening, the woman walking through, there was no control. And then we have the inferential understanding that kind of shakes us, that it's like, oh, well, there was also no control over the sensations in the turning and the intention to turn, because it was just causes and conditions coming together. So this is how, just pointing to how the noting practice can guide us in bringing us more precision and more continuity of mindfulness. Because in a way, it keeps us, one of the things it does is it keeps us a bit accountable. How do we know that we're really having a close awareness of what's happening in some moments if there's not a bit of noting there? So how does the seeing of not-self help us as we seek to impact the world in any way that we want to do so, that would be of benefit? This is actually incredibly empowering, to see not-self more and more deeply. First of all, if we start to see that, you know, ideas about ourselves that, you know, solidify our experience really can't have any truth to them, well, then limiting ideas about what we can't do, messages we may have gotten from society or culture about anything that might be about our unworthiness can't be true also, right? So we start to be able to see through some of those really ingrained patterns that might keep us from being more effective. Any ideas that we're less than or not capable, right? So then we can bring more of our, we can be more effective. We can disconnect and not be so hooked into those patterns that might limit us in life. This is profoundly freeing, to see not self. Another moment that was really moving for me in having the good fortune to hear some of Sayadaw Upandita's talks in Myanmar was, you know, he was a really demanding teacher, as people said, and I saw this even in just seeing his Dharma talks. And so, you know, I have to tell you, you know, it's fair to tell you all that this is Mahasi light that you're experiencing in terms of Mahasi practice. So that, you know, if you practice in a center in Myanmar, many of them, the instructions will be to be really slow about everything and note absolutely everything, every movement of the body. And so to really be continuous with it. And so Sayadaw Upandita would sometimes come into the hall. He would be driven up to the hall, and then he would walk in, and all these yogis, like more than in here, so more than 100 yogis would be there. And, you know, many of us would be settling in, and he would walk into the hall. And then more than once, he basically made a statement sort of at the beginning of the talk, and with what was sounded like really displeasure in his voice. He was like, at least in the translator's voice, was like, "When I walked in, there were two yogis who sat down unmindfully." Okay? So that was, you know, this was the level of precision that we were instructed to. And it was that level of dedication that was expected of us, right? But at times, to, you know, the real compassion behind that, the compassion that he had and the compassion behind that instruction in terms of the dedication that we should bring to the practice came through, you know, because they were teaching in that way, that we should have that dedication, because out of compassion for us, so that we would be able to experience the insight, experience, know more deeply the truth of the way things are, know more deeply the three characteristics, and be freer and freer. So, you know, even though we would get that kind of a message, you know, you clearly, if you do not sit down mindfully in the hall, it will be noticed. He also said, at a certain point in a talk, it's really important for you to remember that the defilements are not you, right? The defilements are not you. So the hindrances, any, you know, unwholesome mind states you have, mind states of not loving kindness, even non-mindfulness, they're not you. So this is, points to how this practice is freeing, and and how, even though this, you know, it seems difficult, it seems clunky, it seems so rigorous, it's maybe tiring to do some of the noting practice. It's certainly, in terms of the lineage, coming from a place of really believing that this is a pathway towards freedom for many people. And so it's very much worthy of checking out and giving it a go. So I just want to say a few more things. Oh, not too many, though, because I'm really taking up time here. About the noting practice and how it supports us seeing the three characteristics. Ultimately, it's a way to cultivate the perception of impermanence. Because the Buddha didn't just call these characteristics our conditioned experience. He pointed us towards cultivating through our practice of mindfulness the perception of these these characteristics in our experience. So seeing, being able to perceive impermanence. And the Buddha said, this perception of impermanence is tied directly to our awakening, the cultivation of this perception. He said, the perceiving of impermanence, practitioners, developed and frequently practiced, removes all sensual passion, removes all passion for material existence, removes all passion for becoming, removes all ignorance, removes and abolishes all conceit of I am. So as we do this practice and we're noting, one of the things it does is it allows us to see the individual characteristics of experience more and more closely. When we see the individual characteristics of experience, like a moment of softness, a moment of sadness, a moment of pressure, a moment of hearing sound, a moment of seeing. When we see those individual characteristics more and more closely, more continuously with mindfulness, what's universal about all of them at times pops out at us more and more. And this, sometimes we have these small seeings and sometimes we have the big seeings. This is what's kind of referred to as insight. And another way of looking at it is simply that we're really just because we're aware and accepting more of these moments of our experience, that allows us, that continuous acceptance and awareness allows us to see the change. Without that, we can't see the change because we're constantly turning away. We have that shrieking madhouse mind. And the noting practice also supports us in disidentifying from the experience. So having that space from it, that has a seed of wisdom in it, sort of like if you note a moment of anger, there's this way in which it can support just stepping, that internal move of stepping back and seeing that anger for a moment, not as me or mine, right? So, anger feels like this right now. That space, that disidentification, that ability to actually be in contact with and to know that experience in the moment rather than to be caught up in it, identified with it, you know, falling into the mistake of taking it as me, myself, or mine. So we need these qualities of the continuity of mindfulness and the disidentification for the unfolding of the insight to happen. So I just want to point to the kind of the liberation that the last line of the Taijutsu poem refers to. And she opened the clenched fist in her mind and let go and fell into the midst of everything. And I'll just end with that. Thank you for your attention. Just sit for just a few moments. So we have time for walking, and please feel free to.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.